welcome back to Nerds on Words, the podcast covering all things nerdy and all things bookish. I'm your host, Bamfing Bob, also known as Robert Andrick, and today we have a wonderful panel of guests. First, we have three-time returning Brian Spaulding. I like cheap tacos. How are you doing, Brian?
Hey, doing great. How are you, Bob?
I'm kind of wrecked after Marvel Avengers Infinity War, but I am ready to talk all things superheroish with the book that we have this month. And for the first time, we have Tracy from the UK. Tracy, how
are
you?
No, from Ireland.
Ireland. You're not in the UK anymore, are you?
I'm not in the UK, guys.
I can never remember.
You're okay. You're not the first one to make that mistake.
And
I won't hold
it
against you.
Okay. So how are you doing, Tracy?
I'm all good, yeah. Looking forward to having a good chat about this book.
Yeah, I was really excited for it. My wife read this book a few months ago. And she said she loved it and she wanted me to read it, but I wanted to make sure I did it for the podcast. So she had her sister read it and her brother read it. And finally, at long last, I read it. It's a story about a world taken over by superheroes, and the good guys are running the government, and the bad guys, they're trying to bring back a status quo that they'd reached in an age of anarchy. Two young characters must fight with one another and also their own hormones to get things done in the way that they see fit. And Marissa Meyer brings it all to you with Renegades. So, Renegades, first off, are either of you young adult readers?
I read everything.
I am occasionally a young adult reader, yes.
Because I like to read a lot of different stuff, mostly in the sci-fi fantasy realm. But because my wife is such a big fan, I tend to pick up young adult more than anything else. A lot of adult fiction kind of feels a bit too deep, a bit too verbose for
heavy.
Me. They try to bring in a lot of heavy science and a lot of heavy themes, and really sometimes you need just a fun book to kind of escape into. And I feel like Renegades does that very well.
Oh, definitely. It's got a very comic book feel to it. I think comic book, like young comic book readers will enjoy this book because they'll be able to connect it with other young sci-fi fantasy books that are out there as well. So I think it's a really good one to kind of introduce people to the thoughts of good versus evil and how it's not very clear cut.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I thought it was a pretty good book. It is something where when I finished it, I wasn't exactly sure who the good guys and the bad guys were.
Yes.
Because everybody had a point to what they were trying to do. But it is certainly a fun read. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the best stories, especially in the superhero genre, are the ones where the villains are so relatable that it's hard to kind of tell who is good and bad. They're the hero of their own story, but if you use some semblance of common sense, they could be the good guys in a different scenario. In any other scenario, call heroes villains and villains heroes, this would still be the same type of book.
Yeah.
So this podcast is going to be a little less spoilery than the last one, because as returning listeners know, Ready Player One was the one we did last month for the month of March, and if you haven't checked that out, I highly recommend it because it ties in some of the movie news that we did.
I would definitely recommend it.
It is a very fun movie, book, and podcast, so check those out.
Well, the podcast was phenomenal. I have to be honest with you. I didn't see the movie yet. I just read the book. Obviously, I didn't get enough time to finish it to be on the podcast, but after reading the podcast, a lot of the book made a lot more sense.
Well, I hope I didn't spoil the movie too much for you.
But that's okay.
Books
are always better anyway.
But this one for Renegades, we're going to talk basic themes, characters, not going to dive into too many storylines because there are a few hanging ends that lead into a second novel that's debuting this November called Arch Enemies. So this book does end on a very cliffhangery type of note, and I don't want to tell you how that comes to be, but I think there are a lot of themes and characters and motivations between those characters that we need to discuss to kind of get a feel for this very superhero heavy novel.
Yeah. Teen Titans meet X-Men.
Kind of. With a little bit of a political overthrow kind of thing in there as well.
Yeah, I would agree.
No, that's still X-Men.
When I read it, I honestly thought this is what it would sound like if Ayn Rand wrote X-Men fan fiction.
Yes.
And I saw a whole lot of that independence, those who are strong and willing to do the work will survive. And I actually draw a lot of parallels with a book that is seemingly controversial these days, The Fountainhead, that she wrote back in the 40s or 50s, I believe, mm-hmm. with some of the political story and some of the reasons for one of the groups, the anarchists, and their movement and what they're trying to do with the world. Have you read that book?
I have not.
No, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's...
If I was making a comparison, though, I thought where you're coming from with the anarchist's point of view, it was very kind of teen style 1984.
Hmm. Yeah. The 1984 analogy, I could definitely see that. In terms of the political side, we've had this whole battle and we're 10 years after the battle, where the anarchists and the renegades have fought and the renegades have won. And so now they're kind of in control of everything. But with that being the case, they don't really know how to govern. They're just kind of winging it and doing the best they can. And they've created these laws. But it seems like everybody in the world is just like, well, you exist and you're super and you have powers. So why should we try? And I don't know how I feel about that. It seemed to make everybody who is not super or has a power feel kind of lazy. And I think maybe that was the point, but it's hard to digest a little bit. It seemed almost like a class warfare, mm-hmm. where humanity was stuck in the middle.
Mm-hmm. I would agree completely. Yeah.
I read a book a little while back called Red Queen, which is an amazing novel, and there's a series of books behind Red Queen, and if you haven't checked that out, please do. Victoria Aveyard, I believe, wrote it. But it's a story between the supers being the ruling class, the rich, the powerful, and then the regular people who are the serfs, the peons, the merchants, the things like that. The Glass Sword is one of them as well. Victoria Aveyard wrote it. And this book felt very similar to that, but I kind of draw the comparison between, when smartphones came out and everyone was saying, oh, well, so everybody's going to be so stupid, right? Because you can Google anything at any time, right? If you need to find a place, you pull out your Google Maps. If you need to listen to a song, you don't have to worry about finding the CD. You can just pull it up and have it with you. And it kind of led to this thing where you're going to get dumbed down. And all of humanity is going to be lost because the work is done for you. And the opposites kind of sprung up so that people are innovating, trying to make things better. And now that they have the resources at hand, those motivations can be brought to life. But in the book Renegades, it is kind of like, the humans are lame ducks. They are there to be saved. They're there as victims. They're there as cannon fodder. They don't really accomplish much because the renegades have developed their own politics and they govern law. They play judge, jury, and executioner. And they also try to help things like education and infrastructure. And they are trying to rebuild the society that they blame the Age of Anarchy brought. I'm going to read the inside cover of Renegades just so that those of you who don't know, that you can got to get an idea of what's happening.
Have we lost a podcast member?
Have we? Brian, you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Oh, you're there.
just making sure radio silence is never a good thing. Okay, so the blurb for it says, secret identities, extraordinary powers. She wants vengeance, he wants justice. New from Marissa Meyer, author of the number one New York Times bestselling series, The Lunar Chronicles, comes a high-stakes world of adventure, passion, danger, and betrayal. The Renegades are a syndicate of prodigies, humans with extraordinary abilities, who emerged from the ruins of a crumbled society and established peace and order where chaos reigned. As champions of justice, they remain a symbol of hope and courage to everyone, except the villains they once overthrew. Nova has reason to hate the Renegades, and she's on a mission for vengeance. As she gets closer to her target, she meets Adrian, a renegade boy who believes in justice and in Nova. But Nova's allegiance is to a villain who has the power to end them both. So, that's the basic idea that you go into the novel knowing. But even 2 pages into Renegades, it gives you a list of characters. And this really helped me out. Because a lot of times going into it, especially as a comic book fan, back in, I think, the 90s or something, all of my X-Men comics, and even now today, on the first page, there's a list of characters with their names, aliases, and a picture of them, and sometimes it has their abilities or backstories. That way you go into it not in the dark. Right?
Mm-hmm. I have to be honest, though. I think sometimes the joy of reading a book is finding a character and learning who they are as the book progresses. Don't get me wrong, I love my intro pages on comic books, but when I'm reading a novel, personally, I like to start to invest in people mm-hmm. and get to know who they are through what they do rather than their synopsis at the front. Because the character list that we have, it's just there's so much more depth to each person that we meet as we go through this, you know, societal mix, you know, and it's just so much better to kind of keep going with the book and learning about these people, learning why they do what they do. For me, that's the joy rather than having the little page going, oh, that's who they are. Because then you kind of don't put as much stock into what they're doing.
Right.
Because, you know, oh, that's what they do in the end.
No, because my issue with it is that because it dives so heavy into it right from the get-go, I had character overload. At the very beginning, you know, they'd say, oh, yeah, Simon does this. And you're like, who the hell is Simon? Right? But then you go to the front, you're like, okay, so Simon is the Dread Warden. He can turn invisible. Okay, got it. But then the next time you read Simon, you're like, now, who was that? Because you get like 10 other characters in between. Like Nova and Adrian Sketch, they're easy to remember, right? They're the main characters from their point of view.
Yeah.
This goes from a multiple point of view format where it switches between chapters or groups of chapters between characters. So you kind of get to see things from both an anarchist point of view and a renegade's point of view. But let's talk about the 2 main characters. First, let's talk about, I would argue, the main character, which is Nova Artuno, Nightmare. Nightmare is a young woman. I think she's put it 16 years old in this book. And she has the ability to put people to sleep with her touch, as well as to never go to sleep herself, which comes in handy because she uses those extra hours to invest in her own personal talents, like hand-to-hand combat, dealing with technology and chemistry. She mentions juggling at one point, needle point. Mm-hmm. She uses her extra time to really hone her skills, where people who need that 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night, they just can't. The anarchists are a group of people that were run by Ace Anarchy, which was Nightmare's uncle. Now, this is a mild spoiler, but if you read the first chapter, it's given away. There's a little preface, and there's the preface, and then the very first chapter, it is explained who Nova is in relation to everybody else and what's going on. So that's not a big spoiler. But going into it, we find out that she is now living with this group of anarchists that are not run by Ace, because Ace was defeated in a big battle, the Battle of Gatlin. They live in Gatlin City, and so all of these renegades who came and they fought, they were able to defeat most of the anarchists who believed that these prodigies were being... what's the word? It's very much an X-Men type thing. They're hated, they're feared, they're being persecuted, some people hate them, most people despise their very existence. So the anarchists go and they try to even the playing field by creating a chaotic dog-eat-dog world until the renegades come and cut them down to size.
Yeah, I that's one way of looking at it. And then the other way of looking at it is that these people had to come in to try and feed the world that was there, that was being left. I think Nova's character from the very get-go, from that first scene with her sister, her family, it's more than what has happened in the past. I think it's about more than that. It really, you know, it encapsulates why she has her rage and anger and who she is. But it's not just because people hate what she is or hate what other people are. I think it's a societal, you know, she has grown up in this tier system, and she's grabbing on with both hands to try and make things better the way they see it, not just the way, you know, the good guys supposedly see it.
Yeah, and I would say also the character of Nova specifically, from the events of the first chapter that occur moving forward, I can only think of one person in the entire book that doesn't really use her as a means to an end. In fact, the entire story that's based around her is other people trying to get her to do things for them to advance their own cause. And she seems kind of blind to that by her rage of the events of the first chapter. And frankly, I think just based on the way that this book ended, because I know that there's going to be a sequel and we'll probably dig more into this, but I felt that her rage was misplaced. Mm-hmm. She was angry at the wrong people, because as we find out throughout the book, the people that she's angry at are the ones who didn't come in and
yes,
answer what she was asking for at the beginning of the book. I'm being a little cryptic because I'm not trying to give any spoilers.
No spoilers here.
Right. But I feel like Nova's approach to it is a bit unrealistic, because in the events of the first chapter, it happens when she's a very small child. It's before
yes.
the fall of the anarchists. So
yes.
When she's a child, she sees them, and this is very mild, but she expects the renegades to come in and save the day. And when that fails to happen, she calls it oversight on their part. It's their fault for not being there. When really, as adults, we know that, you know, mistakes happen. You can't be everywhere at once. And it's really easy to hold grudges when the people who you thought you were depending on don't come through.
Right.
And that small little nugget was grown and built upon by the anarchists until it was a full-blown vengeance story where she's out to take down the renegades from the inside. So let's talk about, we have the secondary anarchists, and there's some really interesting characters. There's a puppeteer character who looks kind of like a marionette, an embodiment of fear, a Boom Boom type character from New Mutants, a very interesting fashionista named Queen Bee who controls wasps, bees, and hornets, and her sort of father figure of sorts, Cyanide, who can create poisons. And then, of course, there's Ace Anarchy, who ran the whole shebang until the Battle of Gatlin. But in the present day, this is their first... They've been hiding in the tunnels and the subways, and they're finally ready to take out the renegades once and for all. And there's an assassination attempt in the first couple of chapters that... unfortunately doesn't work out as planned.
Never does.
I know, but that's what drives the plot. It's that evolving drama. But in so doing, Nightmare is a big part of that assassination attempt. And she is encountered by a team of renegades. Now there's the main renegade council, which are the ones who took down the anarchists in the beginning. And since they've taken over, they've created several other teams made up of prodigies who are trying to work toward the end of safety for everyone, rebuilding, getting things back to where they want to be.
Well, the Renegade Council have gotten older.
Oh yeah, and they are.
That's the thing.
They're not
they're
really heroes
much anymore. They're being celebrated as the heroes of past.
They're now the mentors and the and
they're now the Professor X.
They're the school board, yeah, essentially. but there's a team led by Adrian Everhart, who is the son of two of the Renegade Council members, and he has a very interesting power. Sketch has something called Artwork Genesis, I believe they refer to it in the book somewhere. But he can bring his own drawings and artwork to life. So, you know, he's hungry, he draws an apple, he brings that apple to life and takes a bite out of it. It's a very interesting power that has a very wide scope of uses, which he really dives into in this book.
He's fantastic in the way that he uses his intellect to be intelligent with his drawings. You know, he uses his drawing abilities for what is needed, for when he, you know, assimilates into his alter ego, we'll call it. The way he was able to draw things that made suits come out of his body for his it's a very unusual talent because it means he could have any power that he really wants. Mm-hmm.
He's the most unique character in the book, and he's the one that I gravitated to the most, simply because of his demeanor and the way that he viewed the world and what he was trying to do. He, of everybody, seemed the most innocent, even though he's really kind of a patrol person and goes out and kind of fights crime, so to speak. I think that he had his head screwed on tighter than everybody else.
He was maybe the most pure, I think.
For sure.
And he also has the most to prove, because he's kind of been grandfathered into the Renegade before the whole – there's a process called the Renegade Trials where normal prodigies off the street have a chance to become Renegades through a sort of auditioning American Idol-type process. I mean, literally an American Idol process. Yeah, and it's really fun to watch, but Sketch – Adrian is a character who has used his ability to grant himself other powers via tattoos, kind of like Ink from the X-Men.
It's slightly different. I don't think that's the best analogy.
It is different. Well, I mean, but it is kind of the same idea where he gives himself abilities via drawing on his own skin, so that if he draws if he drew a water hose on his body, then he would be able to spout water out of his hands. Just an example. That's not really in the book, but it's just that sort of thing where if he draws an X on his body, that could mean that he could kill somebody, or he could he could find things very specially depending on what he wants to do.
He's boundless, though. That's the thing. For a character that's in here, like they could have gone so much more with him, and maybe they will in the next book. But, you know, compared to all the other people, they all have one or two talents, you know, they've one or two gifts. This guy is, you know, he is above all of them, yet he is so pure of heart and so secure in his own knowledge that what he believes is right, that he doesn't reach his potential. Mm-hmm. And then he's also he doesn't get corrupted the way a lot of other people would be when they have that kind of power.
It helps that he's so underrated, because this is, this kid, he draws stuff, but he can't, you know, shoot lasers, he can't fly, he can't do any of these really cool, flashy powers, so really he's an arsenal. He's great to come up with things, but he doesn't actually do much, so he has to go the extra mile to say, no, I deserve to be here, and he's really an asset, not in a different way. So by him embodying this alternate persona as a superhero that uses all of these tattoos, he's able to really jump forward and put himself out there, a step above these other heroes that have joined the Renegades.
And in doing so, he also really sets forth, and he's basically breaking the rules of the Renegades by doing some of the things that he does. but he's doing it for all of the right reasons, so to speak. He's doing it because the renegades, after being in power and ruling for 10 years, they've put in place all of these rules that make it almost impossible to go out and, you know, and police and investigate and do all of the things they need to do. It's like if you put superheroes in shackles where they all had to abide by a certain set of rules before they acted upon any type of tip of a crime or any type of mischief going on. He found a way around that. And that's one of the things that I like most about this character.
It's vigilantism at its finest. It's where it's where there's a set amount of rules that need to be followed in order to do things. Kind of like Daredevil, you know, like he follows the rules when it's important and when he can do what he can within the realm of the law. But where that doesn't work, then Matt Murdock has to become Daredevil and do the things that aren't exactly sanctioned by the law. And Sketch kind of does this, but in a much more of a Boy Scout kind of way. He doesn't stalk rooftops at night. He has to put on his suit and be the shining hero that people have been looking for. But in doing so, and being a vigilante, and he's going against what the Renegades have set, he's making himself a target, and people have to question whether or not his intentions are good and whether or not he is a villain. And that duality between both of our main characters, Sketch and Nightmare, or Nova, the duality between are they a villain, are they a good guy, is really strong throughout the entire book.
And I think they both bounce from one to the other throughout the book. Mm-hmm. You know, in what they do and how they interact with other people and with the general public and then with each other. I think they do, the lines are so blurred within this book, from the what is good and what is bad. I think both of them are heroes and both of them are villains at separate times throughout the book.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's through the character development between the two of them that you're really questioning what is right. Is it the opportunity to, you know, partake free will and do things and make mistakes, and all of the pitfalls that could come with that? Or do you really want somebody who's above you making all the decisions, and having everything be very on the level without any risk whatsoever? I'll bring this up, but being a Rush fan, 2112 was playing through my mind as I read all of that.
Okay. That's an interesting tidbit.
well, no, I mean, the Renegade Council to me, it just came across as the people who were at the priests at the Temple of Sphinx. In the song, and I, you know, the anarchists were the people who were, you know, trying to push through and fight against that, and saying no, individuality really needs to be celebrated more. It really, and that song was based on, again, the book The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. Hmm. So all of those parallels were swirling through my head the entire time I read this.
There is a lot of parallels as well to modern day society, to our society. You know what I mean? About, you know, what is right and wrong. Who, you know, we have all this stuff going on at the moment in the world and in the States, in North and South Korea, in Russia, in Europe. And we're looking at all these things going, well, who's actually right? Yeah. And I think that's really cool in the book that you can actually put things to modern day, and kind of start thinking in different ways, because it does make you think you have to look at both sides here. It's not just who was right and who was wrong, because no one is ever right and no one is ever fully wrong.
Right. If you could justify it, you could say, oh, well, I was right because of X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
No, I tend to agree. I think that there are good points made on both sides of all of the arguments that are presented within the book. I still, after completing the entire book, I don't know who to pull for. I mean, there's the natural part of you that just wants to pull for, you know, the simple rule of law so that everybody can have just a normal life without any strife or without the fear of crazy things going on around you every day. But then there's also the part that you really want to be able to be an individual. And those two in this world that's been created do not meet yet. I mean, I really feel that they will in the next book, which hasn't come out yet. But, you know, I'm really kind of anxiously awaiting to see where this goes.
Right. Definitely. I would agree completely there. I think they're after giving you just enough to keep you hooked for the next book, you know?
Right. And this is kind of where the young adult really, really comes into play here with what you were all saying about, like, not wanting to be ruled by an older, smarter, like, experienced class. Like, sometimes making mistakes, falling in love, doing things that are brash and, you know, without thinking things through, that really does encapsulate what it is to be a teenager and young adult. And so that's where this really, really resonates with me, because it is the superhero story, you know, Spider-Man always messing up, you know, Teen Titans and X-Men and all these characters that are very young trying to make a name for themselves, they end up making the biggest mistakes.
Yeah, and
they are also the ones that we learn the most from.
Exactly.
They are. And, you know, also I would venture to say that in this book, the Renegade Council, the ones who are really kind of ruling, they're making it up as they go along.
Oh, completely.
They were heroes, and when they won, there was no government, so they formed one, and they don't really know what they're doing.
No, not at all. And that's a big thing, is that with the anarchists, they say, well, look, just because we don't know what we're doing doesn't mean that you do either. And what we were doing was working for a time for the people who we care about. And so let's talk about a little bit of the romance of it, because this isn't necessarily a romance novel by any means. But because we have a young male hero and a young female villain who's trying to portray a hero in this, it really creates kind of a will they, won't they relationship that they're both
Batman, Catwoman.
About going into. Exactly. It says you can't fall in love with the villain, but he doesn't know at this point of the book that Nightmare or Nova is truly a villain. What happens in the book is she comes into the Renegades as a spy and tries to become one, a renegade, in order to find out their inner workings, to see how the anarchists can get a leg up, to see whether or not they can take them down. And in doing so, she spends a lot of time with Sketch and his team, and she, a lot of lines are blurred between her trying to look out for the anarchists, her own team, and her own well-being. And because of this new relationship and being around people her age with powers that she hadn't really experienced since she was a child with the anarchists, it creates kind of a weird, awkward, hormonal thing within Sketch's team, with people trying to date
weird,
one another.
A weird hormonal thing. That's a great way of putting it.
because nobody really knows what they want. There are members that are kind of flirting with each other, playing, trying to feel each other out. And then there's these walls that are there.
Not literally, no, lads. Not literally.
Nah.
Just put that out there. Not that kind of book.
No. There are those kinds, though. If you're into reading those, dime a dozen.
But this book isn't.
No. But this does have those really you could cut it with a knife, the kind of tension that they have, because you know that they're starting to build feelings for one another, care for one another, kind of venturing into, well, do they like each other and their own personal goals.
It says like, you know, the school discos. I'm going to send my friend over there and ask her, you know, my friend wants to dance with you. Do you want to dance with my friend?
Yeah, I could have. When they got to the point where they were will they, won't they, I thought that it took away a little bit from the book.
Yeah.
I was really enjoying the story of, you know, the two groups and her infiltrating the Renegades and finding out more information. But the love interest part, it slowed things down a little bit. And I know that being a young adult book, it's hard to have one without having that involved in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have been really great to move forward without any of that. And I think that it was good. And I do want to give credit to the author, in the way that Nova or Nightmare, when she shut her eyes and she cleared her mind and said no and moved forward with what her goal was. That to me was pretty amazing. And I liked that. She shut it down quick.
Yeah, because, I mean, they both have dual identities, and so it's one of those things where just because you as a person believe one way, would your alter ego feel the same way, you know? And there's a lot of conflict there, and I agree that it does kind of take you out of the superhero story of it, but some of the great superhero stories do involve a certain aspect of romance. I wouldn't call Superman a romantic character by any means, but that drama with Lois Lane has always been kind of the driving factor for the character, because, you know, his alter ego, you know, there's kind of this playful I like you but she doesn't notice me thing, and then Lois Lane's got a thing for Superman. Same thing with Peter Parker and Mary Jane. So I like that they incorporate it, because it's important to the superhero story, but if they try to make it a central theme of the next book, it's much more young adult than anything that the superhero sci-fi fantasy audience would really appreciate. Well, as
this,
much.
This book, I personally, I'm looking at it and I'm going, this book is perfect for a movie franchise like Divergence or, you know, that Maze Runner.
Hunger Games.
Hunger Games, those kind of books, because it's the exact same format. Obviously, the story is different, but the format is still the same. But that's because it is aimed at young adults. It is aimed at that audience. That is their target market. And they will enjoy it. It's just that when you're as an older reader, you're like, oh, come on, lads. We've read this. Let's just get back to what's good.
Right. And that's well, superpower fights. Pew, 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 pew.
Not even that, though. But even the emotion, you know, they can emote so much more, and it doesn't have to be in a love story. That, you know, intimacy isn't just between, two people in a relationship. You know, intimacy is between those moments that you have with people within your life. And, you know, it could have been used better with that, especially with Nova and some of the other anarchist people. You know, she has such an amazing, with Cyanide. Just as a reference, you know, she goes and she doesn't care that he's smelly in his van, you know what I mean? That's an intimate that was fantastic within the book. So it didn't actually need the love interest, because there's so many more parts that could have been emoted better, I think.
Yeah, I would agree.
I do think that that them playing off of one another is a good thing, but it didn't have to be romantic per se, right?
Yeah.
It could have been a platonic, you know, well, I like this character, but I hate them and their alter ego, and finding out things from one another and really playing the other and not knowing it. That could easily be done in a platonic friendship, partner team kind of setting, and not necessarily, ooh, I want to smooch.
Exactly.
Because it does almost fit down to that, you know.
Is that how you ask
it? It almost did.
Ooh, I want a spooch.
you made me giggle when you said it that way.
Yeah.
I know, right? I felt really odd. I was like thinking, oh, we're going to go behind the bleachers.
I will tell you that if you guys just were talking about, this would make a great movie, I think it would as well. One character in particular that I thought was really good, and I couldn't get Mark Hamill out of my mind from playing him, was the puppeteer.
I love
that. Oh, God, yes.
Maybe because of the toy maker that he plays on Flash.
Whenever he's voicing Joker too.
Without a doubt. Yeah, he would be a fabulous puppeteer for that character. You know, just the scene when they were interrogating him, trying to gain some information on
when the very start at the parade.
Right.
You could just see him waving at people in his crazy way.
It was, I couldn't get his image out of my head.
Oh my god! Now every time I think about this book, that's what I'm gonna see.
But there'd be great things that they could do in a film, and they could make it. You know, it wouldn't have to be two. They might be able to break the two books into three movies if they really wanted to draw it out for the money, like Hollywood does. But my big thing about the adaptation is there's so few things that are comic related that don't get adapted really now. And I like that this as a novel can just be a novel and work for itself. Now, both of y'all know I'm a novelist and I'm working on my own stuff right now. And, even though most of the people at Comic Crusaders and Undercover Caves, they're going into comic writing and artwork and things. That's kind of their little hole. For me, I'm trying to write prose. And so reading a book like this, I get to see a lot of the things that work for what I want to do, and also the things that don't work for what I want to accomplish in my books.
I can understand that, because I'm both a comic writer, published, and I'm writing a novel at the moment, too. So I do know where you're coming from, and I'm writing it for young adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of between young adult and new adult. I haven't decided yet. But I'm trying to – I want there to be an element of romance in my book, but I don't want to make it a romance novel, you know. And I feel like this one is pushing almost a little bit closer to the line than I would like to be. But I think Marissa Meyer is an amazing author, and my wife cannot stop talking about how much she loved the Cinder series.
When I got this book, I ended up buying the first book in the Cinder series because I need to read more of what this woman does.
Yeah, and it's great, right?
Well, I haven't started the new book yet because I said I'm going to leave it and have it because I'm going on a little break and I'm going to be bringing it with me. So I'm quite excited.
But yeah, my wife has very, very high high praise for that series, and she has been trying to get me to read it. But honestly, superheroes are a little bit more my style than fairy tales are, even if it is set in space with robots and everything else. I mean, there's something for everybody.
But it's nothing like Saga, so I'm a little bit upset.
But the fact that it stays prose and that it's a big book that can reach a wide variety of audiences, not just the comic book fans, but the young adult readership can read this and be like, oh, I have a new appreciation for superheroes. That really appeals to me as a writer, that
it's
hope.
Definitely branded well for the young adult audience. I think she's done very, very well with how she's laid the book out, especially like the front cover is phenomenal. Like to look at it, it's a beautiful front cover. So that's going to draw you in straight away. And then, like you said, having the cast of characters in the front as a younger reader is going to be so much easier. And like, especially I find I'm dyslexic, so personally reading novels can be very difficult for me. But this novel was laid out so well that I wasn't having to reread things as much as I would normally do, which would be a great thing for her pushing forward with her books, knowing that it's, you know, it will be accessible to a variety of readers and a variety of abilities of being able to read too.
Mm-hmm. But like, Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was going to say one character that they left out of the cast of characters, who I think is probably the most important person in the novel, is Sketch's little brother, who is...
Oh, yes.
He almost an Akira type person, who is locked in a room, in a quarantine room, who basically he's locked in because he basically takes away the powers of everybody else who encounters him, and he absorbs them. Yeah. and so to me, I think that that's the person who's going to bring balance to the Force, so to speak. It's going to be a situation where I think that that ends up being the key. This little kid who has been isolated all his life and is can essentially cure all the ills of both sides of this argument. Of you know, people who are screaming for freedom and people screaming for law. I don't know. What did you guys think of him?
I loved the relationship that sketch had with him. Like, from their very first interaction where he's building his glass house inside his room. You know, this poor kid hasn't had human connection, you know. But his brother, because of his amazing ability to draw, he can push things through to them so that they have that connection. But like you said, it's that fear. He's been put in this box because the people in charge are afraid.
Well, and, you know, rightfully so, because we saw what happened at one point when somebody went inside the box.
Yeah. Don't look at the box!
Right. Mystery box, no. Yeah. But the whole story about how he's been experimented on and how he's being prodded, and there's some allusions to some other things that I won't go into on spoilers, but he's going to be, to me, the most important person in this series as it plays out. He's the key. He's the linchpin to everything that will happen.
Right.
I agree.
Because in his ability, you already went into it, that he kind of saps powers from other people. He's one of the very few characters in this who can wield multiple powers that do not relate to his soul power, right? By his having one power, he can amass others. And so not only does his ability to take away, but also his ability to absorb and use other powers really may make him the turning point for either group, depending on who decides to use him first. And what we were talking about, the character list in the beginning, there are a lot of very important characters that really are not mentioned in it. There's a secondary Renegades team run by a character called Frostbite. There's Max. There's the Librarian. There are a lot of interesting characters that are not gone into in detail in the beginning. Ace Anarchy, he could have had one, but he didn't because he's not a main character in the within the story, even though his existence does play a major role in why things are the way they are. So you still get to read it, even knowing who some people are and what their abilities are. You don't know their backstories. You still appreciate being able to go through the journey of reading the book and discovering who they are.
Yeah, all the secondary characters are very interesting.
So it helps. It does help.
I like the Librarian.
Librarian was good.
Yeah. My little heart fluttered. I'm like, oh, this character's awesome.
Right, so overall, I'd say that the characters in this are what make the book. But the powers are fun, and there's a lot of very interesting plot twists and cliffhangers and things don't turn out the way that you're expecting, even though some of them, to be honest, you see it coming from a mile away. So some of them you're like, oh, that was planted there for a reason, or this is going to come up later. You get these feelings, but I think that's important for this particular book, because if you don't plant those little seeds, then it'll come out of left field and the reader's going to be like, wait, hold up a minute,
WTF, people.
Exactly.
WTF.
Like, there was literally no reference to this whatsoever. But there's little tidbits that kind of let you figure it out for yourself before final reveals and big plot twists.
Yeah, they were good at planting the nuggets. Mm-hmm. Like, the little nuggets of information so that you weren't lost.
Right.
In general, though, as I've said already, I think the flow of this book was very well done. I think she really, really was very smart in how she produced it and how she edited it and how it flowed. So, yeah, it's an interesting read.
The flipping point of views between the chapters was a very good choice. Because from one point of view, this story could not be told with any justice, because we wouldn't know who's who or what's what. and you get to kind of see both alter egos and things put into play so that as Nova is discovering things that that Sketch already knows, that it's still a revelation for the reader, even though the one character already knows and it's commonplace that Max is in quarantine for a reason. Nova finding out firsthand, it serves as the reader also finding out firsthand.
Yeah.
But what I liked about the way they revealed things in this book was when our characters are going through things, depending on whose point of view it is, it impacts how impactful it is. So we knew in some of the last scenes of the book, we knew that there was a plan in place between several characters. And then if you flip to another character's point of view and you see how things play out from that point of view, you get to see where things work and where things don't by knowing what the initial plan would have and should have been. But it's still very interesting seeing how things play out without the main character saying, oh, well, that's not right. What's going on? We know that from the secondary point of view. We can tell just by knowing.
Yeah, I think that they did a really good job of doing the two points of views. I would agree with you on that. In fact, when I was reading through the book, I also listened to it on the audiobook. They had two different people reading the two different points of view through the whole thing. And I found that really interesting. It's almost like two different stories. You've got Nova's story, and then you've got the story of Adrian. And so you're seeing the world through their eyes on each of the different chapters that would deal with whatever they're dealing with. And it was interesting to see. You don't see a lot of books do that. And I think that maybe after reading this, I wonder why, because it worked really well.
Very much so.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of younger books are written that way. You know, I'm just trying to wrap my brain out to think of something like Darren Shan. I don't know if you know who he is. He writes a huge series. He's done that Cirque de Freak.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but he does that in some of his other books. He does that, the two points of view. And again, it's very good to see both because it gives you an even keel so that you, the choices that you make, you don't feel are forced upon you by the characters within the book. It's from what you've read and learned from both sides. So it's really well done.
Mm-hmm. And before we start to wrap up, because I think we've covered most of our plot points that without going into spoilers, I just wanted to mention how many different settings there are in this. This is a book that just doesn't take place in a house or at a place. There are a lot of different settings in this that I really enjoyed. I'm a huge fan of, like, you know, you said Circuit of Freak and things. But I really love, like, carnivals and circuses. I think that's a great setting for things. And there's some a lot of stuff, especially with the puppeteer being involved with a carnival. Library, tunnels, big superhero headquarters. All these settings are really fleshed out, and you get to kind of, you can see yourself in these places, and it doesn't log you down from, oh, well, there's bookshelves here and there's things there. It's all very integrated into the story, so you can feel where you're at without them stopping the plot to provide that setting set up.
Yeah, they did a good job of building an entire world in this book. I mean, most of it takes place within the city, but different places within the city, but they everything has a unique feel. All the different settings are definitely unique and different from all the others.
Mm-hmm. And Gatlin City being a fictional city, they could do anything they wanted with it.
For sure.
Especially because it's a city being re-emerged from the anarchists. You know what I mean? They are rebuilding. They are. So nothing is solid. It's, you know, they are making things as they go within the book as a plot point. And as a reader, I thought that was really interesting.
You don't have to refer to the Space Needle or the Empire State Building or Big Ben or anything being there, because it's completely fictional. They can have anything they want. And the big structure that they have in this is the Renegade Headquarters, which also kind of plays to the fact that they feel like they're bigger and better than everything else. They are the beacon of light to everyone, but also something that can't be stopped. And so, depending on what side of the coin you're on, it can be something that's very formidable and imposing, or it could be one of those kind of gauntlet holy things where you just go and that's your mecca.
Truth and justice.
Yeah.
But so, overall, what are our final impressions and ratings overall on a scale of 1 to 10? Let's start with you, Tracy.
I would give this book a 7, I think, out of 10. There are some things that, you know, could have been handled in different ways and read better, but as a book in general, I am excited to read the next one. So it definitely enticed me to keep going. So, yeah, it's definitely out there for young readers.
Ryan?
Yeah, I will agree. I am pretty much spot on with Tracy. I was also going to give it a 7. I would say that the superhero stories and the story of the characters is great. It was a little bit heavy on the love interest and the confusion that was caused with that. But everything else on there I thought was spot on, and it was really nice.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give it an 8. Because the characters in this make the story. There's just so much that goes on throughout the book, and through the character development and through their personal decisions, Renegades is one of those books that is very character-driven, even though there's a lot of stuff happening around it. Also, obviously, I'm a big superhero fan through my stuff with Comic Crusaders and elsewhere. And so seeing the different powers being portrayed, the different personas between everything, I would give it an 8 solely on it appealing to me as a young adult and as a superhero fan. So overall, that gives us a score of 7.33. I'm really glad that I got to read this, and thank you both for showing up. I really appreciate you reading the book and joining us. Now, next month, are both of y'all planning on reading the Oracle Year by Charles Soule?
Yeah, I think we'll give it a go. Hopefully, I'll be able to fit it in.
Okay, well, we'll see who all can show up in the month of May. As I just said, Charles Soule, who's an acclaimed comic writer for things like Death of Wolverine, Curse Words. He has a very long list of comics that he's worked on, but he's very well loved. And he wrote his first prose novel called It Oracle Year about a man who can see the future. And that impacts his decisions, and I haven't read it yet, so I don't know. But from what I hear, it is a very amazing and complex book. So I look forward to seeing everyone show up next month to discuss Oracle Year. And thank you so much for reading Renegades with us and discussing it with us. And until next time on Nerds of Words, keep reading, keep engaging, and keep being nerdy. Thanks, everybody.